First thing is to review for the test next week. Want to go over the topics that we've covered since the last test, and I wanted to give you some specific types of examples I may ask about on the exam. So we covered a lot of topics when we had that SM1, SM2 lecture a while back. And we're still not at the point where I'm going to ask, why does one particular type of reaction occur versus another? But those were really good examples of mechanisms. And one of the topics we had covered in lecture was mechanism, talking about the difference between cationic and anionic and radical, which I will not be asking about radical yet since we haven't seen any radical reactions. But then we talked about the difference between concerted and stepwise reactions. We talked about some of the consequences of having an anionic versus a cationic reaction. So the SM1, SM2 reactions are such good examples for that that I'm going to say that you need to know just the mechanism for each of those two reactions. And I'll go ahead and rewrite that. First, the SM2 mechanism. In which you can have an alkyl halide be attacked by something like hydroxide. And at the same time that the hydroxide attacks, the bromide comes off. Part of the reason I'm bringing this reaction back up is we've now covered kinetics. When we first talked about the SN1 and SN2 reactions, we had this brief introduction to why they're called SN1 and SN2. So just as these are really good examples of mechanism, they're the perfect types of reactions to discuss in the framework of kinetics. So for example, if I told you this reaction was exothermic overall, you should be able to interpret that this is a one-step reaction, since it is concerted, since all the arrows are being shown in the same step. And so if you wanted to draw a reaction coordinate diagram for a reaction like this, it looked like this.
One transition state corresponding to one step, reactants higher in energy than products because I have said that it's exothermic. We can do a similar type of thing with the SN1 reaction,
which so far the versions of the SN1 reaction that you've seen have all had three steps to them. First, breaking of an alkyl halide bond, forming a carbocation. Then we've seen a couple different things attack, but mainly we've used water as the example. And when we've done that, we've seen several times now that a positive charge would result, and so there's a final step where deprotonation occurs. So if I told you some information about this reaction, like if I emphasize that the first step of the reaction is the rate-limiting step, then you should know that if we drew a reaction coordinate diagram for it, it should have the largest activation barrier of any of these steps. Since this is a three-step reaction, might not ask you to draw a reaction coordinate diagram for it, but let's say I had some totally other example of a two-step reaction. If I said the first step was endothermic, and then the overall reaction was exothermic, then you should be able to draw a diagram like this. First step endothermic, so it goes up to an intermediate. Overall reaction exothermic. So I'll summarize this by saying that for mechanism, you need to know some of the properties of cationic versus anionic reactions, which means knowing something that is stepwise versus concerted. You need to know the two mechanisms that I've shown you here. I might even give you the starting materials, since again, we're not totally responsible for these reactions quite yet, but understand the mechanism at this point, we should. Now, then for kinetics, obviously, I'll be asking about reaction coordinate diagrams, since I've shown you a couple already. And that means you need to know what a rate limiting step is. That's the point of tying S1, S2 to kinetics, to understand where the 1 and the 2 come from, which to review that, for the SN2 reaction, since there's only one step, and there's two molecules in that step, that's why it's SN2. For the SN1 reaction, it is that first step, the breaking of the bond to form a carbocation, that is the toughest step. It only has one molecule in it, which is why it's SN1. We also had a discussion of activation energy. So we had this diagram where we showed that if you had a higher versus lower activation energy, that fewer molecules have the energy to react, and that's what leads to a slower reaction. And we also talked about how changing temperature in itself can change the number of molecules that are able to react. So in other words, in the context of kinetics and thermodynamics, we had one of these energy distribution diagrams. Backing up a bit to thermodynamics. Really, the main thing from this I want you to be able to discuss is Hess's law. Which, in connection to Hess's law, I want to talk briefly about catalysts, which we haven't up to at this point. And let's say I had some simple one-step reaction. And let's say it was exothermic. If you use Hess's law, then what would you say would happen to the overall change in this reaction, the energy, if we were to use a catalyst? Well, what does Hess's law say about the change in enthalpy for reaction? It says that enthalpy is a state function. Which, what's a state function? A function that depends only on the states that you have, the initial and final states, but not on how the change between those states occurs. So in this case, if I have a chemical reaction that has a certain energy gap that's associated with it, putting a catalyst in is not going to change that change in energy. The only thing it does do is it provides a new reaction pathway. It's not even, typically people would say a catalyst lowers the activation barrier of a reaction. That's true, but if you wanted to get really fussy about it, you could say it's not, because it doesn't actually change the reaction you had to begin with. It gives a totally new reaction pathway. And that new reaction pathway itself has a lower activation barrier, which again, lower activation barrier, more molecules that can pass over that barrier, which is why it leads to a faster reaction. So let me just make this statement. A catalyst, and let me point out that this is the catalyzed reaction, and then this is the uncatalyzed. And a catalyst lowers the activation energy of a reaction by providing a new reaction pathway. But if we were to now connect this to equilibrium, and we have this equation that free energy, which I realize that this diagram I just wrote in terms of enthalpy, but let's just say that entropy is a minor component of this reaction, and let's just say for the sake of argument, therefore, that delta G, the diagram, would look similar. Well, since there's a connection between the equilibrium constant and that free energy change, and if a catalyst doesn't change the energy of a reaction,
then that means a catalyst does not affect the balance of products or reactants once you've reached equilibrium. It might get you there quicker, that's what a catalyst does, increases rate, but it will not change the distribution of products
and reactants. So a catalyst does not change delta H or delta G, since Hess's law states those values only depend on the identity of the products and reactants. Thus, a catalyst will not affect the balance of products and reactants at equilibrium. As far as the rest of our equilibrium discussion, you need to know what I refer to as the three definitions, where we talked about equilibrium being a state in which concentrations no longer appear to be changing, in which the rates of forward and reverse reaction are equal, and where you're at the lowest energy point in the system, and therefore the energy is no longer changing. So if and when I ask for the three definitions, those are exactly the ones I'm referring to. Again, no change in concentration observable, equal rates of forward and reverse reaction, and lowest and non-changing energy point of the system. There is also our discussion of Le Chatelier's principle, which will actually come up again in our lab discussion today. There are two more topics that we've covered that would be on the exam. One is delocalization and resonance structures. I just remembered, there's one other big topic I skipped over. Come back to that momentarily. Delocalization and resonance. And specifically, I'm likely to ask a question about this molecule. More specifically, I'm likely to ask about a Smog diagram for that molecule. Why? Because only if you know that that molecule is undergoing resonance would you know that where the negative charge is, it's not really sp3 hybridized because of delocalization, exactly the discussion that we had on Tuesday. Now, the big topic I skipped over is stereochemistry. And obviously, I'm going to be asking again for some R and S configurations. But I'll also, in this case, be asking, well, R and S, and then A chiral versus chiral. But in relation to mechanism, we had these terms, loss, retention, and inversion of stereochemistry. And with the loss of stereochemistry, we also therefore talked about racemic mixtures and optical activity.
Now, I want to do just a brief bit of practice on naming compounds with stereocenters, because so far we've had several examples of naming a compound with just one stereocenter, but we haven't done much. I think I only had one where I showed you naming a compound with multiple stereocenters. At the same time, I want to review a case of doing a naming of cyclic compounds, because we talked about cyclic compounds, but we never really discussed numbering specifically for cyclic compounds. So in fact, let's start there. We'll start with a simple example where I don't even show stereocenters. And that'd be a case like this. So there's two methyl groups and an ethyl group. We have to figure out how to number the compound with the lowest possible numbers. So there's a couple of ways we could do it. One, we could put the left methyl group and make that position one. We then have two different ways we could number around the ring. One way, going clockwise, the next lowest number would be a 3. But if we went the other direction, the next lowest number would be a 4. 3 is lower than 4, so this would actually be the correct numbering, going clockwise, 1, 3, 4. Well, what are some other possibilities? Well, let's make the other methyl group position 1. So if I number one way around the ring, 3 would be the next number. If I number the other way around the ring, 2 would be the next number. We don't even go past that point to see what the next number after that would be, because in numbering, it's the first place where some difference occurs. So 2 is less than 1. So if we kept numbering around, we would actually get 1, 2, 5 as our set of numbers. But let's look at one more possibility. What if we made the ethyl group position 1? Well, then again, we have two choices. Going to the left, going counterclockwise, our next number would be 2. Going clockwise, our next number would be 4. So 1, 2 would be lower. And so we'd have the numbers 1, 2, 4. Now, if you compare the first and the last one, we have 1, 3, 4 versus 1, 2, 4. Because 2 is lower than 3, this last one is the correct numbering. Now, the question came up in the other section, what if you switch the methyl and the ethyl group? Well, it doesn't matter. And the reason the question came up is, well, E in ethyl is lower than M in methyl. So would that change the numbering? No, because you only look at alphabetization if you end up with a tie. If you end up with two different ways to number that have the same numbers. So in this case, you'd only look at the substitution pattern. So questions about this example before we do something with stereocenters. All right, well, let's do the stereocenter example then. Somewhat reminiscent of a problem on your quiz, a cyclohexane with two centers on it. Now, for numbering cyclohexane compounds, the standard process is if you only have one of the most important substituent on the molecule, you don't have to number the ring because it automatically assumes position 1. So an alcohol is more important than alkanes or hydrocarbons in general, which is more important than halogens. So the alcohol would automatically get position number 1. And so since it automatically gets it, we just call it cyclohexanol. Now, if we had two alcohol, yes. Yeah.
You don't look at chirality in that molecule?
I was saying let's not even worry about it, just to figure out about numbering. And in this case, you wouldn't be able to determine RNS anyways because I use just all flat lines. So if you don't have that information, you don't have to worry about that information. Now back to this one, if we did have two alcohol groups, then we have to use numbers. So let's say if I put another alcohol at the 2 position, then it would be cyclohexane 1,2-diol. The numbers do appear. Yes?
Right. Why don't we cyclohexane 1-ol?
That's just the standard practice. That's actually the recommendation, not to use the numbers. Now, we do need to name the substituent, though. It is at the 3 position, so it's going to be 3-bromocyclohexanol. And now we worry about the configuration of the stereocenters. So top stereocenter, R or S? Yes, some of you are doing it right. Yes, R, clockwise. Why? Alcohol, priority number 1. Go both ways around the ring. The one with the bromine is different first than the other side, so position for priority 2. Continue around to the other part of the ring, that's priority 3. Hydrogen, the least important group, is in the back. These are precessing clockwise, so yes, it is R. Bottom stereocenter. So, bromine is 1, the side of the ring with oxygen is 2, the plane side is 3, it looks like it's S, but remember the hydrogen's pointed at you, so it's really also R. Now for, yes? That was the same question that came up a moment ago, because I can't. Because I don't have wedges and dashes. If you don't have a wedge and dash, there's no way to determine what the configuration is. And sometimes, if you don't care about the configuration of a molecule, it'll be written just like that. So it's not wrong necessarily to represent a structure that way. But if you do, then you can't name it fully. Now, when you're naming a compound that has multiple stereocenters, doesn't matter what's R or S, or in fact, later on when we talk about E or Z, you just list all of the configurations in numerical order. So you don't list R's before S's or E's before Z's or anything like that. You just go 1, 2, 3, 4 in order of stereocenters. So position 1 is R, position 3 is R. So this is 1R, 3R, 3-bromocyclohexanol. Yes? Yes, it would be cyclohexane 1,2-diol. Okay, so that is stereochemistry. The last topic then, which we'll review in the lab section, because timing-wise, that's where we'll have the time to more fully discuss it. Hyperconjugation. Because if you can handle conjugation, you should be able to handle hyperconjugation. Again, we'll have that hyperconjugation discussion in the lab, so just for the moment, I'll say, let's skip on the questions. But this should be a fairly complete list of the topics that we have covered since the last exam. So any questions before we pick up with what we really needed to do today, which is to finish off acids and bases. All right, well then let's go ahead and start. Now some of this discussion will continue on Friday, since we had a bit more review than I had originally anticipated. So I had originally said that the lecture on Friday won't be on the exam, and so it'll be a sharp cutoff point. At some point, I'll say the rest of the discussion will be for the 3rd exam. But I just want to be able to wrap up cleanly the discussion tomorrow of what we're about to start, which is a discussion of strong versus weak acids and bases, a discussion of what is neutral versus what is neutralized. And here's the type of example that we're going to discuss, something like acetic acid and sodium hydroxide, very similar to benzoic acid and sodium hydroxide, which you had in your first experiment. Acetic acid is a weak acid. Sodium hydroxide is a strong base. What does it mean to be a weak acid? What is the definition of something that is a weak acid? Yes.
Say it again.
It doesn't want to let go of its hydrogen. In other words, it doesn't dissociate very much. A weak acid is an acid that only minimally dissociates. Now, we could write an equilibrium constant for the dissociation, so we could quantify that dissociation. And an acid dissociation, classically represented just like this, HA, where H is the proton that's going to come off, A representing acid, going to dissociate to make an H plus and A minus. Equilibrium constant is products over reactants raised to appropriate stoichiometric coefficients, but since everything's in 1:1:1 ratio, Ka itself is fairly simple. Concentration of H plus times A minus over concentration of HA. But earlier I had shown you this equation, the delta G is equal to negative RT natural log of K. Well, for a weak acid that doesn't want to dissociate, that means it doesn't want to make a lot of products, that means that Ka is going to be much less than 1. Well, that means that delta G is going to be greater than 0. A reaction that doesn't want to go forward spontaneously is because it's an uphill energy reaction. So if I wanted to draw a reaction progress diagram for that kind of process, it would look like this. Again, positive change in delta G causes the equilibrium position to want to be closer to reactants. And so here's the story we could tell. When we have acetic acid all by itself in the solution, it doesn't want to produce much H+. Let's say we now neutralize it with a strong base like sodium hydroxide. And if we pretend that that reaction is complete, that each mole of hydroxide reacts with a mole of the acetic acid, well, that means you're going to be all the way over on the right-hand side of this equilibrium curve. Because you forced all those protons off, you forced that reaction to go all the way forward. But once you're there, once you're neutralized, then what that means is the acetate that's left over, that's only just the product in this equilibrium. There is no more acetic acid to be in equilibrium with, so the only thing it can do is react backwards, which means it's going to pull an H plus from whatever happens to be around, which if we're talking about hydroxide, that means it's pulling it back off of water. So even though you might have had 1 mole of acetic acid and 1 mole of hydroxide, they will not react all the way to completion because that would give you a Q much greater than K. So Le Chatelier's principle says that if you've upset the equilibrium that acetic acid would have had, instead of just dissociating a little bit, if you force it to go all the way to dissociation, then this graph is going to show us it's going to go backwards, which means even though you've neutralized the solution will not be neutral. Now, since I've used those two terms, neutralized and neutral, let's talk about them a little bit. Before we even do that,
because I know this is going to come up at some point. Let's just remind ourselves what pH is.
pH is just a measure of the H plus concentration in solution.
And specifically, it's defined as the negative base 10 log of H plus concentration. So, what is the definition of neutral?
So, that is true, but only at one temperature. So, what would be a more general definition?
That's right. It's when the concentration of H plus is equal to the concentration of OH minus. Now, why is it not always pH 7? Well, let's talk about the auto-ionization of water, which is that all by itself in solution, liquid water will dissociate into H plus and OH minus ions. So neutral water makes one of each of those two. But this is not a favorable process because you're pulling apart water. You're making H plus OH minus. Those are the old simplified definitions of what is an acid, what is a base, something that has H plus, something that has OH minus. So these things really want to react. So why in the world would this dissociation occur at all? Same reason water evaporates at room temperature. Some of the water molecules have just enough energy that they're able to dissociate. But that means that if you change the temperature, you're going to change the number of molecules that do dissociate. So at roughly room temperature, it is true that the H plus ion concentration is 1.0 times 10 to the negative 7th molar, which means you're going to get a pH of 7.
But as you change temperature, you change the number of molecules that dissociate, you change the H plus concentration, and so you get some pH that's not 7. But it's still neutral, because neutral comes from the idea that when water dissociates, only one H plus and one OH minus are made in balance with each other, therefore. So pH, you have to adjust with temperature, which if you took Chem 1B here and you used the computerized pH probes, you might remember you had to change the temperature if you did a variable temperature experiment.
So the safe definition is that H plus concentrations equal to OH minus. What, therefore, is the term neutralized?
Yes.
That in a reaction, number of moles of acid is equal to the number of moles of base.
Which these are not the same definitions. Because if you have different acid-base strength, then that means one way you could say it is a weak acid may only make a little bit of H+, a strong base would make a lot of OH-. Put the two together, you're not going to end up with a neutral solution. Yes? Yeah. Neutralization is to make neutralized, not neutral. So neutralization is where you're going to react equal moles of acid and base. Now if you're being for the lab quiz, we did neutralize, but there we weren't trying to even be careful about it. We just flooded it with base to force complete neutralization.
But should we assume that in that reaction we have equal number of moles of acid and base?
No. I mean, that's all that would have reacted. Your limiting reagent would have been the acid. And that is called a neutralization reaction because you have gotten rid of the acid. But was that exactly neutralized? No, because you had an excess of the base.
Okay.
questions. So I don't know if we just had a lot more questions in the other section or if I had more caffeine today. But we actually had gone through everything that I did in lecture with the other section. So since we have enough time to, I'm going to go ahead and put the discussion of hyperconjugation in now, since it is a lecture topic instead of a lab topic. Got just the right amount of time to cover that. So, hyperconjugation is the reason that we said that tertiary carbocations form more easily than primary or secondary or methyl carbocations. At the time we had that discussion, I remember doing a tertiary carbocation and a methyl carbocation, but I never did write out, I think, a primary and secondary SMOG diagram to show the different levels of interaction that can occur. So I wanted to go back and do that as part of our review. So we'll take a tertiary, a secondary, a primary, and methyl halide. So we'll take T-butyl bromide, isobutyl bromide, ethyl bromide, and then methyl bromide. And, sorry, we don't want the halides. We want the carbocations. So methyl carbocation, ethyl carbocation, isopropyl carbocation, and T-butyl carbocation. The central atom in each of these examples is going to be sp2 hybridized, because each one of those central atoms only has three bonds to it. And then for the methyl group, that's all you've got. For the others, the rest of the carbons would be sp3 hybridized, because they would all have four bonds to them. So let's go ahead and draw out the centers in each of these first. Notice that when I write these centers, I try to avoid putting any orbitals written straight up and down. Because if you have sp2 hybridization, that means you're going to have a p orbital that you have to draw in later. So you want to avoid having that p orbital overlap with your sp2 orbitals. For the methyl group, all you've got left is hydrogens. For the ethyl, there's only two hydrogens. For the isopropyl, there's only one. And no hydrogens on the T-butyl. Got a bunch of P orbitals. Fill those in real quick. And then we have our sp3 hybridized carbon. So one more on the ethyl. Ooh, that color's not working well. Oh well. Two for the propyl. And then let me rewrite this below. Didn't leave myself enough room. Three on the T-butyl. And then a bunch of hydrogens. Now, remember that the single bonds are constantly able to rotate. So these interactions I'm about to draw in, don't necessarily all happen at the same time. It's going to be more the idea of how many neighbors are there that interactions can occur with.
So in the case of the methyl group, you might recall that we had discussed that there
is a 90-degree angle between the sigma bond and the p orbital. That means they completely fail to overlap. And so there's no chance of an interaction.
So there's no hyperconjugation interaction. In the ethyl case, there is one sigma bond that, as it rotates around, it every once in a while will line up so it can have an interaction with a p orbital.
Now, the difference between conjugation and hyperconjugation is this. In conjugation, you have, in the examples we've seen so far, p orbitals, multiple ones of them, that completely overlap with each other, which means the electrons are free to move around between all of those different p orbitals. That generates new molecular orbitals. So just like when two p orbitals overlapped, we made a sigma bond and an antibond, we saw for the allyl system how that generates three orbitals. Three p orbitals making three molecular orbitals, a bonding, a non-bonding, an antibonding orbital. Hyperconjugation is something totally different. I mean, it is related in the sense there's electron density being moved around. But the sigma bond on that sp3 hybridized carbon stays a sigma bond. Its energy might be changed a little bit by hyperconjugation, but the bond is pretty much localized. A little bit of that electron density, like the fringe of the bond, happens to interact with a little bit with that p orbital, which helps spread the charge out a little bit. But it's not the same as delocalization then, because there's not new molecular orbitals being made. It's just a small interaction. But that interaction is, although small, is enough that the more interactions you get, the easier it is for that carbocation to form.
So in the ethyl case, we only have one hyperconjugation interaction. But for the propyl case, there's two hyperconjugations that could happen. And in the t-butyl case, there's three hyperconjugation interactions.
Yes? Yes, it is. Always? For all the examples I can think of on the spot, yes. Because if you had another p orbital, it'd be conjugation. So it's a p orbital interacting with some kind of sigma bond. And, well, no. There is one other case where if we went back to ethane, the different rotamers of ethane, that's a sigma bond and a sigma antibond that hyperconjugate with each other. But where we'll normally see this come up is, yes, in the discussion with p orbitals. Yes? The way I've drawn it, it's the top of this lobe interacting with any of the three atoms, but the bottom of the lobe could interact as well as this thing rotates around.
So which one of the two?
Any of the three sigma bonds in this case. And actually all of the hydrogen can rotate around as well. So what I'm referring to is this position, that position, and that position. So as they rotate around, every once in a while the p orbital and that sigma bond lined up. And then if it turned 180 degrees, it would line up and overlap with the bottom part of the orbital. So just as it's spinning around, there are these small interactions that keep on happening. Yes?
So there will be possibilities for both the upper part and the lower part.
Yes.
Conjugation.
Yes. And again, the timing is random. As these things spin, they happen to line up. So it's not that they're coordinated like this, not that they're all happening simultaneously. It's just that for the tertiary carbon, you have three places it could happen, three times the chances. For the propyl, you only have two chances. For the ethyl, the primary carbon, only one chance.
But and sorry.
Yeah, what's that?
It doesn't happen at the same time, right?
Not necessarily, no. I'm just drawing it that way, again, to emphasize
how many possibilities there are. And the summary statement then is the greater amount of hyperconjugation the more stable the carbocation. Now that sentence needs to be qualified, and that's the part of thermo we never quite had the chance to discuss, but I don't want to just throw it in right before the exam. So after the exam, we'll come back to this, because we're going to be starting heading towards alkene soon. We do have SN1, SN2, of course, that we need to review as well. But we have the perfect place to talk about this word stable later on. So for the moment, I'll just make the general statement. More hyperconjugation, more stable carbocation. Yes?
So conjugation is totally better, because hyperconjugation only has a little bit of interaction to help stabilize, but conjugation has actually forming new molecules, so it's much stronger.
Yes. Yes. Other questions? All right, so we now are out of time. I've got office hours now. When we come back to lab, we do have lab lecture today, which means we don't have time to do the lab today. Because if you have read through the pre-lab, you know that we're going to be doing a distillation. You need the entire lab period to do that distillation. So I'm giving you a heads up, because to be efficient time-wise, I'm therefore going to do a double lecture today so they don't waste the time. So next time we won't have a discussion. Today we'll fill up the time with discussion, and I'll lead you through first what we're going to do for the setup for that distillation lab, and then we're going to start NMR, because we need several weeks to catch up with that. No, we're not. No, I had mentioned yesterday, in fact, that we would be canceling the second distillation. And I'll discuss why when we come back for lab lecture. Right. Technically, you should have had it for today, but you wouldn't be penalized because we're not actually starting the lab today.